the pandemic is surging unchecked, and the CDC is pleading with us not to travel for Thanksgiving and not to spend the holiday with people from outside our household. It is COVID and your health on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Thanksgiving guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is firm. Our hospitals here in Wisconsin are treating almost 2,000 COVID patients, hundreds in ICU. Frontline healthcare workers, what do you need now? If you're fighting COVID or helping a loved one through it, what questions do you have? How are you changing up your Thanksgiving? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. Allison Schwartz is Associate Medical Director of Infectious Disease for SSM Health's Wisconsin region, where she treats patients in Madison and Janesville. Dr. Schwartz, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Well, SSM Health has three hospitals, two nursing homes. How are you in this surge? How are your facilities right now?
We're definitely in surge mode, so working every day. I know there's, you know, a comprehensive team of administrators, physicians, and others who are working to help prepare. We're seeing our numbers rise sort of at this exponential rate, just as we've seen around the state. And so continuing to plan as a system, how do we handle this increased flux in patients and how it affects the other services that our healthcare system is able to provide. Certainly doing things like bed planning, vent planning, but also things like staff planning, because we've, as there continues to be community spread of COVID-19, there have been, you know, staffing impacts, which we need to take into consideration as we move into this busy holiday season.
Yeah, what should healthcare providers, frontline healthcare workers do outside of work to prevent transmission of COVID? Because staffing levels have suffered greatly from transmission outside of hospitals, not inside at their work.
Exactly. I think you're exactly correct. A lot of the exposures and a lot of the staff members who we've seen have to go out of work, unfortunately, may have been exposed to COVID-19 in the community or possibly even had a family member exposed, which is resulting in them needing to quarantine for 14 days. And that definitely impacts, you know, their ability to come to work safely. We don't want to expose any patients or expose their coworkers. And so it's just as important for our healthcare workers around the state to continue to follow all the guidelines which we've set forth up until this point, you know, recommending things such as the physical, you know, social distancing, hand washing, mask wearing. It's going to become a particular challenge as we move into the holiday season, but really pleading with the general public as well as our healthcare workers to take these recommendations and the CDC's recommendations into consideration and, you know, alter your family's plans. That it's disappointing for many, but for the greater health of our community and for your family, it is just 1 year and we're looking forward to, you know, there's some good news in the world of COVID-19 on the front. There's sort of light at the end of the tunnel with some of this vaccine news, et cetera. And so really just pleading with the public and making sure that people understand the significant risk that the virus poses to them, their family, and our greater healthcare system and the community this winter, and really wanting everyone to be safe and do as much as they can.
Dr. Schwartz, have your PPE requirements in the hospital and what should be worn when, has that changed in recent weeks or months at all?
So when we talk about going back to kind of the beginning of the pandemic, we're learning a lot about how the virus spreads. And I think initially there's a lot of questions about, is this a droplet spread virus or some discussion about airborne spread, and just sort of to distinguish for the public. So droplets are basically any sort of, you know, singing, talking, when you cough, when you sneeze, even when you breathe, this produces respiratory droplets. So the idea is that there's virus contained in these droplets, and as you come into contact with the respiratory droplets, you could then, you know, inhale the virus, or it comes into contact with your mucous membranes, and that's how people get infected. So as you get further away from someone, there's less droplets. There are also smaller droplets as you get further away, and so there may be less viral material in those droplets. I would contrast that with airborne, which are these particles that sort of linger in the air, maybe for minutes or even hours. So we think of things like tuberculosis or measles, chickenpox virus, all of those are airborne viruses. So measles, for example, can stay in the air for up to several hours, which is where you'll hear of an outbreak or an exposure at an airport, because maybe a coughing individual was in a terminal. You not only worry about the people directly in that area, but potentially for hours after that. So we're still learning a little bit about COVID, and there's definitely this this idea that there may be some airborne component to the virus, and particularly when people are in enclosed spaces with inadequate ventilation, or maybe the infected person is breathing heavily, there may be more of this airborne generation. And so at the hospital, we are taking into consideration what patients may have, you know, a higher risk for producing some of this airborne virus, and recommending in many situations that our healthcare providers are wearing N95 protective masks, which help sort of seal off healthcare workers so that they do not come into contact with those droplets, or those airborne particles. So it's a little bit different than when we were really just recommending uniform mask wearing in the hospital, because there are certain instances where there may be a risk for airborne transmission. And so we've had to shift our PPE practices slightly, but really just to protect our healthcare workers, trying to keep everyone safe.
How is your supply in PPE and respirators at this point?
At this point, we are doing well. I think we're fortunate in Wisconsin that there was, after the initial surge in the spring, we did have a period in the summer where there was less virus and we were seeing less positive patients in the region. And with that sort of lull in cases, we were able to sort of build some of our supplies. And so the supply chain picked up, and we've not felt a strain in our healthcare system, that we've gotten much better with our PPE. And so that we've been able to handle things thus far. But again, as the cases rise, that there's sort of this, a swinging curve that if we need more, could we end up in a shortage situation again?
Dr. Allison Schwartz is with us, infectious disease specialist at SSM Health. We're talking about COVID, the surge. Have you been diagnosed with COVID? What was quarantining like? How do you cope without seeing family or friends? What do you want others to understand about the virus? 800-642-1234. Kurt is joining us in Elkhorn with a question. Hi, Kurt. What would you like to ask?
Well, on the day of the announcement from the administration about the COVID-19, it was said that if a person had COVID-19 and died of the cause of 19, that their death would be marked as such. But also, if you had been infected, but let's say died a heart attack, that death would also be included, commingling the numbers.
Okay, so you're wanting to know specifically about cause of death, how that's being reported, and the comorbidities taking into consideration here with COVID-19 when someone dies. Dr. Schwartz.
Sure. I think there's been a lot of controversy about this, and I think it's important for the public to understand how sort of a death certificate is filled out. And so there will be sort of the primary cause of death and then these secondary causes of death. And so in an instance where someone comes in and they, you know, have severe COVID-19, they go into respiratory failure, they develop pneumonia, they require ventilatory support, all of those, even though the primary cause of death may be, you know, acute respiratory failure, it's going to be due to COVID-19. And so the instance what Kurt's talking about is if someone came in and they were in a car accident and they died from the car accident and then they were found to be COVID-19 positive, clearly the cause of death would be documented as such as, you know, the car accident. We would say in that instance, COVID-19 would have nothing to do with it. I think what's important to recommend understand is that something like a heart attack could be indirectly related to the COVID-19. So both of those would be listed on the death certificate because it's a vascular disease and can cause other downstream effects such as heart attacks or other strain on the heart. And so therefore, it would be appropriate to list both items.
Allison Schwartz, infectious disease specialist with SSM Health, Dean Medical Group. We're talking about the severe spread, how you can help limit the spread at Thanksgiving. Have you been tested? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. The CDC and state public health officials plead us not to travel at Thanksgiving. Are you heeding this guidance? We're discussing COVID and your health this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Here's DHS Secretary Designee Andrea Palm at Wednesday's pandemic presser.
As scary as this picture is, it is going to keep getting worse before it gets better. And it is only going to get better if we take action to make it better. Please stay home. Do not gather for holiday celebrations. It is not worth the risk.
Is someone in your house battling COVID? What do you want to know about caring for them? Is a loved one hospitalized? What questions do you have about treatment and acute care? 800-642-1234. Dr. Allison Schwartz is an infectious disease specialist, and she stays with us. Dr. Schwartz, how have treatments for COVID in hospital changed in recent months, in recent weeks? Is treatment changing at all?
Treatment has changed quite a bit since the beginning of the pandemic, and this is a reason that I think we have seen, you know, some improvement in our mortality rate with the disease. We know so much more now than we did in the spring, and in the spring we were really just, learning as we go and trying to figure out best course of treatment. Now we have much more developed treatment algorithms, and so those are the things you hear about in the news, remdesivir as an antiviral medication. Everyone's heard a lot about steroids, and truly I think steroids have been the most important intervention that we've started using for our patients with severe COVID-19. We also have learned a lot about just basic kind of what we call supportive care techniques. So things like proning oxygenation, which is where patients who are in the hospital with COVID or sometimes even patients at home, we recommend that they can turn on their belly and breathe that way so that more air can reach parts of the lungs that would not otherwise be reached when they're laying flat on the back. And so we've seen a lot of good things. There's more to come. We've heard in the news, you know, in the recent weeks about things such as monoclonal antibodies, which are sort of another exciting potential treatment, which would be given very early in a patient's exposure or diagnosis with COVID-19. And the hope being that if we're able to give the monoclonal antibody, it would inhibit the viral replication. So again, preventing them from getting severely ill. So there's a lot going on and sort of, you know, a big improvement from where we were in the spring, which is good for our patients. I think there's unfortunately no magic bullet. And so despite all of these interventions, it's still a very serious illness and the timing of everything is very important, but we've come a long way from where we were in the past.
Yeah, convalescent plasma was a big push in the spring and the summer. Where are we at with that?
That's a really good question. So convalescent plasma right now, our big issue with convalescent plasma is actually supply shortages. And so I can tell you that what we've found in our sort of treatment algorithms, if you're going to give convalescent plasma, and there's still more data to come on this, but again, this seems to be more of an antiviral medication. And so you want to give that convalescent plasma, which allows someone else's immune system who had recovered from COVID-19 to help tamper the viral replication within the infected patient. And so again, the timing's very important, but what we're running into right now is actually supply. So to get convalescent plasma, what it requires is those patients who've recovered from COVID-19 infection to go and donate their plasma, and then it can be given to other patients to help them fight the infection. And as our numbers continue to increase, we have so many positive patients that we actually have run into issues where we may not have convalescent plasma to actually give those people.
We have Dr. Allison Schwartz of SSM Health with us detailing the risk of COVID-19 and the treatment protocols underway in hospitals. She's part of the infectious disease team, taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Jordan is with us in Eagle River. Hi, Jordan. What's your question?
Hello, first of all. I've been about 2 months I contracted and recovered from COVID-19. What are my risks of reinfection or spreading it to others around me this holiday season?
That's a really good question, Jordan. This is something we're still learning about. There is an idea that we think patients can become reinfected with COVID-19 because we just don't know how long the immunity from infection will last. And so if you're within 2 months of your infection, the idea is right now you should have no active virus from that initial infection. So, you know, you would as long as you've otherwise been safe and haven't had any new exposures, you would be considered low risk to your family and moving into the holiday season. The thought is that, you know, that far out from your illness, there'd be no replicating virus. That being said, we would still recommend that you, you know, generally adhere to the public health recommendations, the masking, the social distancing, et cetera, because we just don't have enough data about the virus to be able to determine how long you'll be considered sort of protected. And if there's lasting immunity, we just don't know yet.
Jordan, thank you for the call. John in Grant County wants to ask about the flu. And first of all, how can you tell the difference between the flu and COVID-19?
So in regards to the flu, as we move into the flu season, we have not seen much circulating virus here yet in Wisconsin, but that's where the urge to the public comes, you know, get vaccinated now to protect yourself early. The winter season is already a busy time of year at the hospital because of things like influenza infection, and so it's important we all, especially when we think about the strains on our healthcare system, that we, you know, really do everything we can to protect ourselves from these other infections. And there's going to be, at some point, when we start seeing more flu spread in the community, there will be you know, testing that needs to take place to help distinguish when a patient comes in, you know, with fevers and respiratory distress, do they have flu or do they have SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19. One distinguishing feature that I think is quite interesting, you know, COVID-19, one of the characteristic things that people see is this loss of taste and smell. Mm-hmm. That would be very unique to the COVID-19 infection. That's not something you should see with influenza. Both diseases, you can have obviously high fevers, you can have respiratory distress. Some of this cough may be more with the COVID-19 than influenza, but the body aches, muscle aches, et cetera, there can be crossover between the two. So we know with influenza, we do have safe and effective vaccine that's, you know, readily available. We would recommend everyone to get vaccinated now to help protect yourself as we move into the winter months where we may be seeing both of these infections.
John also wanted to know, to ask if the flu is airborne.
So the flu is not considered to be airborne. It is more droplet transmission, and there can be, you know, this idea of contaminated surfaces. And so what we're doing with the mask wearing and the hand washing and the physical distancing, everything we're doing to protect ourselves from SARS-CoV-2 will also protect you from the flu. And so for that reason, we are hoping that, you know, maybe we'll see lesser of a flu season if people can, you know, maintain some of the public health guidance and continue to follow these recommendations through the winter months.
So, Dr. Schwartz, on face masks, does a face mask protect me or just the people around me? Explain how those work.
Sure. So the initial thought was that the face mask at least certainly protected those people around you. So if you are infected with SARS-CoV-2, and again, we talk about those respiratory droplets, which contain virus, if you're wearing a mask, that should actually protect you from spreading any of those droplets out into the surrounding air. As we've learned more about masks, and there have been some recent publications which suggest that the wearers may also be protected as well. So again, it's the general idea that, you know, you won't be touching your face and you won't be, you know, touching your eyes or other things. It's sort of this good reminder, but actually that barrier may protect your mucous membranes from, you know, any respiratory droplets around that you could potentially breathe in or come in contact with.
Early on, we were told to make sure to preserve the N95s for healthcare workers. Is that the same protocol now, is to don't wear the N95s if you're not in a healthcare setting?
So all healthcare workers who wear N95s have gone through something that's called a fit test, because mm-hmm. N95 masks are actually, you know, fitted so that you have the right size. An improperly fitted N95 is not going to protect you. And if there's air leaks around, you know, that's another potential way that your droplets could give out to other people. So I would recommend that, you know, if you have access to an N95 for some reason, to make sure that it's properly fitting. If you have not gone through a fit test, and I wouldn't necessarily put all your weight to say, oh, I'm wearing an N95, I'm 100% protected, because you may not be able to say that. And again, that's why all the other measures in conjunction with the mask wearing are going to be so important.
Have you seen the coronavirus mutate in any significant way? And I say that, is it changing in any way that makes people more or less sick, or is it pretty stable?
So we're still learning more about that as well. It seems to, what we understand is there seems to be some mutations, but they don't seem to be so clinically relevant that it's made a big impact on things such as our treatment algorithms and or our vaccine development. So there is, you know, more to come on this as we learn more. Some viruses, what we'll see is as they become more infective, meaning that it's easier to infect other people, they may actually be less virulent. And so we're sort of waiting to see if that's a trend we'll notice with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. It's not something that I think we can definitively say at this point.
Allison Schwartz is an associate medical director of infectious disease for SSM Health's Wisconsin region. We're getting the latest on how to limit the spread, how physicians are treating acute cases of COVID. And your questions, are you coping with a loss at this Thanksgiving? Has a family or friend of yours died from COVID? Has that influenced your perspective about how we think of the coronavirus? What safety precautions have you been taking and want your family to take at this point? Be part of this conversation, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Dr. Schwartz after a news update on the Ideas Network. Our country's top public health agency, the CDC, says do not travel. Stay with your household this week. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our hospitals are taxed. Frontline health workers are falling ill, causing staffing shortages, as we've heard. Governor Evers at Wednesday's COVID briefing.
As always, Wisconsin, please stay home. Wear a mask if you have to go out, but otherwise stay home. Call it what you want, flattening the curve, stopping the spread, staying safer at home. I'm going to call it what it is. It's about saving lives.
Have you been tested or talked with a contact tracer? How is COVID affecting you or your loved one's health? What do you need now? 800-642-1234. We have SSM Health Infectious Disease Specialist Allison Schwartz with us for the hour. Let's go to Gary in Brookfield with a question. Hi, Gary.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. It's a question that I've had since the advent of this regime with COVID, and that is this a virus more like the flu or is more like chickenpox, where you can get that chickenpox, you've had it, you won't get it again. Flu, you can get every year. And so with the flu, we go out and we get a flu shot every year. Is this going to end up ultimately being a situation where we'll get a flu shot every year and we'll also end up having to get a COVID shot every year?
Gary, thank you for that. Dr. Schwartz.
That's an excellent question that Gary had, and I think we're still waiting to learn more on that. As we talked about, it's not quite as rapidly changing as the flu. So we know the reason we have to get a flu shot every year is because the virus actually mutates every year to these new strains. You know, we talk about H1N2 or H2N3, et cetera. That's why we need to get vaccinated every year, depending on what flu is circulating around. SARS-CoV-2 does not seem to change that quickly, so we may not need a vaccine every year for those reasons. However, what we don't know is when we talk about these new vaccines that are being developed right now, we don't know how long the immunity from those vaccines is going to last. And so I know, of course, we're all very excited about the vaccine news that's come out in the past couple of weeks regarding some of the leading candidates for the COVID-19 vaccine. However, it's important to recognize that as soon as people start getting vaccinated, the studies will continue. And so these are going to be long-term safety studies and then long-term efficacy studies to answer Gary's exact question. Once you get vaccinated, is that vaccine immunity going to last, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, et cetera? And so then we'll know. There are other vaccines, for example, one of the pneumonia vaccines, you need to get a booster after 5 years, or similar to like a tetanus vaccine where you get a booster after 10 years. And so maybe this will be a scenario like that where, if you don't need a vaccine every year, but maybe you need a booster vaccine, every few years. And that's what we're waiting to find out.
Yeah, time will tell when that comes out. Gary, thank you for that. Frank in Delafield is next. Hi, Frank.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm 73 years old. I'm in fairly good health, and I had the flu shot. I've not been tested for COVID, and I'm just wondering what the recommendation is as far as getting tested in the future, or if the if you don't have any symptoms, if you just stand by.
Yeah, sure. So if Frank doesn't have symptoms, what should he do? Should he be tested?
I would say generally not. You know, at some point we may have more like wide scale testing to continue to screen our asymptomatic population, but not right now, Frank. I would say just continuing to adhere to the public health guidelines, because although you are, you know, otherwise healthy, you say just being 73 and being of male gender actually does put you at risk. And so I would recommend, you know, staying at home, wearing your mask, doing all the things we talked about. If you were to come into contact with someone who had COVID-19, then, you know, the discussion about testing would be different, or if you yourself started having symptoms. But right now, we're not necessarily testing, you know, wide-scale asymptomatic people unless there is a specific risk factor.
Frank, thank you. Ray now in Janesville with a question. Hi, Ray.
Good morning. Hey, I have a question about the vaccine. I mean, I'm 61 years old. I'm considered essential worker because I drive truck every day. But the way I understand the vaccine's going to go, it's going to go to the first responders first, which it should. And then it goes, the way I understand it, goes to 65 and older. And then it goes to other people with other medical problems. But what about the essential workers? Are they classifying us just the general public now after we've been out here for 11 months?
Ray, thank you for that. Do we know about the rollout and how the vaccine will be distributed, Dr. Schwartz?
We don't know all the exact details. I think Ray is correct. Everyone's, you know, sort of the initial phase. So phase one is meant to include our healthcare workers and then our most vulnerable populations. And so that may be, you know, elderly patients at an assisted living facility, et cetera. Beyond that, we don't know. But I agree with Ray that someone like him who is an essential worker, he sort of fits in that in-between category where he's not 65 and older and he may not have other health conditions. We're still waiting to see how the prioritization falls. And the other thing to note is we're, you know, the vaccine companies are saying they want to scale up production very quickly. And so although, you know, the initial numbers we're talking about are relatively small, they're talking by early 2021 to really be able to scale up. And hopefully, you know, Ray would be in somewhere in that priority list to get vaccinated as he is on the front lines.
We have Dr. Allison Schwartz, an infectious disease expert. We're discussing the risk of gathering and what we need to know now about COVID. With your questions as well, 800-642-1234. Perry is joining us in Adams. Hi, Perry. I understand you've been asymptomatic. Oh, Perry, can you hear us? Okay, Perry is asking, Perry had COVID, was asymptomatic, Dr. Schwartz, and Perry is wondering, can I get COVID again?
Yeah, so we touched on this a little bit earlier, and right now, it does seem that there is a risk for reinfection. It does seem low. We're sort of just going off case reports and sort of hearing about other instances around the country. Someone who is tested positive for COVID, it's important to note that typically if they're tested again with a PCR test within 3 months of their initial infection, they're going to continue to test positive. And that's just about how our testing works, that it detects genetic material of the virus. And so even if there's not live circulating virus, you could still test positive. So that doesn't mean you're reinfected, but rather it could just be a persistent positive test from your previous infection. But we're still sort of learning more about how long, if you are going to be immune, and what the risk for a reinfection is. And it's sort of case by case report at this time. And so I would recommend you continue to, you know, generally adhere to the public health guidelines and consider yourself at risk.
Let's bring in Saul in Stevens Point with a question. Hi, Saul.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I'm concerned about the number of people that say they do not want to be vaccinated. And if the vaccine does not have very long-term effects, then, of course, we always stand the danger of unvaccinated people recirculating the virus, or more likely it coming from abroad again, and people have lost their immunity to the vaccine. So I think it's really super important that everybody gets vaccinated at the same time. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Saul, thank you. What about working toward herd immunity, Dr. Schwartz, and what is that?
Right. So herd immunity is basically when enough people in our population are protected from an infection, whether that be by natural infection or by vaccination. And that in and of itself, then when you don't have susceptible people, then the virus will not spread. So it's important to note for the general public, we've never had an infection that achieved herd immunity by infection alone. So when we talk about infections that have reached herd immunity, that's because of vaccination. So a lot of people have been asking about this. If we just let everybody get infected, won't that help, stop the pandemic? And we've never really seen that successfully play out before. Especially when we talk about our vulnerable populations, I think it's just really impossible to let an infection run through a population and protect people who would otherwise be at risk. But the comment that was brought up about vaccines is very important. You know, a vaccine that's safe and effective, but nobody takes it, then is not effective at all. And so I think we're all, anxiously awaiting the data and knowing that the FDA is going to comb through the data from our vaccine companies to make sure that they would not recommend a vaccine that's not felt to be safe. And as I mentioned before, even once a vaccine gets approved, whether it's by emergency authorization or through the full approval process, they're going to continue to collect data and make sure that this is safe and then figure out some of those unanswered questions as, how long does it last, et cetera.
Yeah, so efficacy is one part of the piece here, but uptake is certainly another driver here, the number of people who take that vaccine.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly correct. And I think the drug companies have tried to be quite transparent with the process, and they've increased their numbers of enrollment and tried to increase diversity in the populations who are in the studies. And so trying to get, capture a broad range of patients in the studies that's reflective of our population so that we get that really good safety data so that people will feel comfortable taking the vaccine, and that'll improve our uptake in general.
This is normally a very busy holiday travel week. How concerned are you about the upcoming holidays and the COVID situation?
I'll be honest with you. I am actually very concerned. I think, we're hearing reports that the travel seems to be not too far off baseline travel for this time of year, which is, pretty concerning to me as an infectious disease specialist and the trends we've been seeing in our hospital. I think that early on in the pandemic, a lot of the outbreaks we were seeing were meatpacking plants, other clusters at bars and restaurants, et cetera. Then we sort of transitioned into this period where it was a lot of, weddings, funerals. And now recently, a lot of the infections we're seeing are these sort of living room gatherings. And so where people think, oh, it's just a few people, I'm not at risk, or my family will be fine. And then, one person unknowingly brings an infection into that setting, whether they be pre-symptomatic or only mildly symptomatic, or even, these asymptomatic individuals. It's something we worry about a lot, and that's where we really want to continue to stress the importance of these recommendations from the CDC and our public health experts.
Allison Schwartz, Associate Medical Director of Infectious Disease for SSM Health. Is your loved one scheduled for a surgery or a checkup unrelated to COVID? Is your appointment on? What have you told your college student or your elderly loved ones about Thanksgiving? What is your plan? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation with infectious disease physician Allison Schwartz. We're looking at the deadly surge of the virus in Wisconsin, around the nation, which has been blamed in part on pandemic fatigue, and what this means for a holiday week when families usually travel and gather together at Thanksgiving. Let's bring in Bert now in Stevens Point. Hi, Bert. What is your question?
Good morning. My question is, and I think we've gotten really close to this, but haven't quite touched it, is let's say I was affected 2 months ago. And so, I've had a negative test since then and everything's fine. So now can I travel across the country safely, following protocol, wearing my mask and whatnot? Is it impossible for me then to spread it to someone else? or how, you know, how safe am, not only am I, but from giving it to someone else at that point.
Dr. Schwartz, what would you say about this scenario?
Sure. So in regards to your infection that was 2 months ago, you're definitely not considered infective from that. So what we found about the virus is typically in patients who were not severely ill, they are typically not considered infective past that 10 days. And so a lot of times, you know, that's where we hear about when patients need to isolate because they've become infected. That's where that 10-day window comes from. So at this point, you would not be considered infective to, you know, give virus to anyone else. If you are planning to travel for the holidays, I would definitely, you know, do all of the things that we've been talking about. Certainly car travel, you know, car driving in your own car would be safer than flying because we just don't know how protected you are from potentially getting infected again. But in regards to your primary infection, you would not be considered infective to your family. And so if you felt that your family has been safe and you don't worry about, you know, they've been able to quarantine and not bring virus into a setting, you would not be considered a risk to them at this point.
The risk on college campuses, let's take a look at that as college students go home. What can a family do to avoid exposure, spreading COVID once their college student returns home?
Right. So, I mean, ideally, that would have been a talk to have with your college student before they came home, that, you know, up until that 14 days prior to coming home, really for them to, you know, hunker down and kind of quarantine as best as they could or reduce their risk for infection as best as they could before coming home. Because kind of worst case scenario would be, you know, they are exposed to the virus just a few days before coming home. They don't realize they're infected. They come home, develop symptoms, and by that point have already, you know, infected several other family members. And so maybe people are already home for Thanksgiving, but this is something they could think about for the Christmas holiday or the other upcoming holidays, really to do what they can on campus to be safe. And then once they come home, or depending what the situation is, if that's not really possible, then if you can maybe separate an area in the house for your student, whether, you know, staying in the basement would be a safe place for them to sort of quarantine for a period of time. Also mask wearing. I know it sounds silly, but that person, when they've been outside of your house, is not considered part of your household. And so until they've been, you know, reintegrated into the household for 14 days, they're really considered an outside person who could be at risk for bringing the virus in. And again, what we're finding population-based is that as a young college student, that person, if they were to get infected, you know, the chances are they would probably do quite well with the infection. But again, the risk is the other family members and who they could potentially infect along the way, or other, you know, even community members if they're out and talking to a neighbor or what have you. So trying to keep that person isolated, you know, for as long as you can to then, you know, reintegrate them back into your household and know that you can kind of create a safe bubble from there.
When you look at that safe bubble, anyone at your Thanksgiving table who is not normally there for dinner every night is outside of your bubble. Who should not be gathering at Thanksgiving?
Correct. And so this is where the CDC has really, you know, made recommendations that avoiding any gathering of members who are outside of your primary household, just like you talked about. Those of you who are at higher risk, so, you know, have medical comorbidities, something that makes you immunocompromised, maybe an underlying cancer or heart disease, age greater than 65, those are the people who would really recommend, you know, maybe just telling your loved ones that for my own safety, I'm going to stay home for Thanksgiving this year. Anyone that you bring into that bubble is a potential risk to spread infection from that standpoint. Other recommendations the CDC has made, that if you are going to gather, you know, trying to limit those gatherings, it's really a cumulative time of 15 minutes. And so I know that doesn't seem like a long time, but, you know, maybe stopping by and saying hello, making sure everyone's masked, ideally doing any sort of visiting outside is going to be the best. I know we have inclement weather here in Wisconsin, but, you know, we go to Packers games, we can bundle up, you know, do what you can to get creative and keep your family safe. If you are going to be in the home, try and open the windows to improve the ventilation in the area. Also, if you are going to gather, then trying to avoid food or drink. So could you just have a small visit with your family and then actually eat your meals separately? Really would be the safest thing. The idea being when you're eating or drinking, that's when the face masks are coming down, that's when people are spreading respiratory droplets to other people and potentially infecting their loved ones. You know, anything with alcohol, just because that does impair the inhibitions, people start to mingle more freely. Those are things that we would really try to avoid as we move into the holiday season.
We're talking with Dr. Allison Schwartz, infectious disease specialist in Madison. We're discussing COVID and the holidays. Tony is with us from Egg Harbor. Hi, Tony. What is your question?
Good morning. Thank you for the show. I'm a 40-year mechanical contractor and part-time tinkerer, and I think my industry has been egregiously remiss in not coming up with methods of sanitizing commercial buildings. So I'm building a air scrubbing unit. It'll filter about 2 million CFM per day, but it will have all four disciplines of MERV 13, UVC, ionization, and maybe ozone. I wanted to get the doctor's opinion on the desiccated active coronavirus cell. A, how long does it live in a building? And B, would those four disciplines abate the positive aspect of the cell?
Yeah, Tony, thank you. Can air filtration systems stop the virus?
Definitely. I mean, I'll be honest, it's a little bit high level for me, Tony, as far as like some of the specific details of what you're talking about. But in general, having an upgraded filter system is going to be better. Again, that keeps the air moving. And so filtering out any virus that's there, sort of the same idea as being outside, right? It's the stagnant air where the virus can kind of linger and then stay for longer periods than we would normally expect in sort of a droplet exposure. And so I think what you're doing sounds great. I don't think it completely replaces, you know, the idea of trying to physically distance from people or the mask wearing, as we talked about. But that is sort of the upgrade that we're talking about when we think of people being creative and trying to increase airflow so that maybe you would feel more comfortable having some of these limited gatherings under the appropriate circumstances.
When you talk about being outside, does weather affect the spread of COVID outside?
So we know that regular coronaviruses, so the other, you know, this is a whole family of viruses that have been around that we've known about. And typically when we talk about coronaviruses, many of those are the ones that cause things like a common cold. And so they are typically seasonal virus. And so that's not what we're seeing with SARS-CoV-2. It didn't seem to slow down much in the summer at all. We just had the ability to be outside more. Generally, the winter months are felt to be worse for these types of viruses just because of the air quality, that it's drier, so the virus can linger longer than in the air versus like the moist air where it would sink more quickly. And so, and the other thing about winter is obviously just people moving inside, and that's why we think of it as being such a risk.
Dr. Schwartz, we only have a few seconds left. Is there anything you can leave us with in this holiday week that we can be optimistic about, but we can also be safe as possible?
Sure. I think, you know, again, just to emphasize, there is some light at the end of the tunnel with some of the good news coming out of the science community regarding vaccines and these monoclonal antibodies. Really just plead with the public, the CDC's recommendations to stay safe and make smart choices as we move into the winter months. Again, thinking about you, your family, but really your community, and then the healthcare workers who've been on the front line since the very beginning. It's, you know, as we see the numbers go up, it's been really hard for our healthcare workers to see, you know, some people disregarding the public health recommendations that are being made. And we'd really plead with you, if we can just get through these next few months, there is some light at the end of the tunnel.
Dr. Schwartz, thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you so much for having me, Kate. I appreciate it.
Allison Schwartz, Associate Medical Director of Infectious Disease for SSM Health. And for disclosure, SSM Health is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just ahead, it is 1A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.